I assume you know what we're talking about here. You remember in the Roman Empire, give them bread enough to eat and give them entertainment, then they'll be docile and they'll do whatever you want them to do. That's the way the Romans dealt with the citizenry of Rome at a certain point in time. All three of us have kind of a different take on this issue. We also know and trust in the Holden's community ability to take a theme and run with it. And we don't know where this is going to go, and it may swerve off into a number of different areas, but that's okay, because that's why we want you here, and that's why we want you to be able to express yourself as you see fit. So each of us is going to now say a few short comments about the theme as we see it from our own point of view, and we may even embellish it a bit and add some things that were not there in the beginning. And then we just want to open it up so that you can either respond to what we say, or that we can hopefully start a conversation with each other. So I guess as the moderator, I'll begin briefly. What this theme means to me, coming specifically from my experience, I tie it a lot to what I've been talking about here for the last week, and we'll talk about again tomorrow and the next day, is the Rwanda genocide. That's the specific instance. It's on a more broad basis. It is the fact that we get a lot of information that calls itself news that really isn't news. I frankly have been rather horrified. I've lived out of the United States now since 1991. I left in September of 1991. And I must tell you, some of my great heroes, I think if I could go back and do it over again, I'd probably be a journalist. But my great heroes were all those fantastic people who worked in the beginning of CBS News. Ed Murrow in London, and one of my great heroes, Eric Severide, and these people who brought such an integrity to the news, who could comment on it, who gave you some background, who allowed you to put this information into perspective. And now what it seems to me when I come home, and I must say, I know what's going on, because in Geneva we have a satellite for our television, and we can get the CBS Evening News or World News Tonight, whatever. We get it the next morning. And I happen to get up about 6 and I turn it on, so I know what's going out under the guise of a news broadcast, and I'm just horrified. I'm astonished. It seems to me that what we're doing is we're playing to this this aging boomer generation, of which I am certainly a member, and what you hear are things about Alzheimer's disease and how to deal with prostate cancer, and I mean, it's just incredible, and it's not news, or it's movie stars, or it's gory stories, or whatever. And in the specific case of Rwanda, what I've said in a number of occasions is, and it's quoting a book that I've used in the presentation, is that what these images that you saw were so horrifying, but they were used, it seems, just simply to horrify, and that there was no background. You had no background information about what had caused, what were the circumstances behind these horrible pictures that you were seeing. So that's essentially my concern. How do we, as a country that is now called the last great superpower in the world, how do we operate? How do we know the rest of the world when much of the news that we get is sensational and isn't real news at all?
Okay. Building on that, I guess I'd like to make three quick points. One is the question of empire and its impact on information. Do any of you know the name Jack Nelson Palmyre? Jack is a friend of the village and been here on several occasions. He and his wife worked in Central America for 6 to 8 years trying to feed the poor, and came back disenchanted because they felt that the thing that got in their way most often in trying to feed the poor in Central America was American foreign policy. And Jack has done some research on a organization that exists through the CIA called the Center for Low Intensity Conflict. and it's an organization within the CIA to essentially wage war against the poor. There's a book by Paul Meyer entitled War Against the Poor, and Paul Meyer says this comes from lessons that we learned through Vietnam, that one of the main lessons that we learned is that if Americans thought that we were involved in an immoral event, that they would be angry, that they would be concerned. And so in Jack's book, he documents CIA decisions that have placed agents in the last decade in places where they can intentionally distort news to the American people so that we don't have the most accurate picture of what's going on. I'd like to read just a couple paragraphs from a book by Walter Brueggemann, a book entitled Prophetic Imagination, and he's commenting on how the Mosaic community of the Hebrews, a community built around Shabbat, built around peace, built around justice, was being transformed by a person who cared more about what Brueggemann calls a royal consciousness. In the Mosaic culture, covenanting, taking care of each other, taking care of our brothers and sisters was an essential part of living a Sabbath way of life. Here's what happens to it in Solomon's time, according to Brueggemann. Covenanting, which takes brothers and sisters seriously, has been replaced by consuming, which regards brothers and sisters as products to be used. And in a consuming society, an alternative consciousness, which is what he suggests we need to develop while living in a royal consciousness, is surely difficult to sustain. One other point, the royal consciousness of Solomon's day was so completely contained that criticism had no viable alternative ground and did not need to be taken seriously. If Solomon had had television at his disposal, he would have managed to buy the harshest critics and make them talk show celebrities.
And he wrote that quite a while ago.
That could it be that if we live in a culture that would like us to be misinformed, that information has the possibility of becoming entertainment, and that if television also lives within the market economy and they continue to give us what they think we want, that gives us a very, very powerful lever, and it's what my final point is, that as Christians in an information society that is also a democracy, what is our responsibility to demand justice in terms of the information that we get? And as daunting as that may seem, I have a sociologist friend who inspires me from time to time by telling me little tidbits like this. He says that, Bill, did you know that only 8% of a people moving in a new direction is a movement? So what would it mean, 8% of your church at home, asking that the media be more accountable, asking that the media work harder to give us a fuller picture, such as Carol has been providing us? And what is your responsibility, what is our responsibility as Christians in a democratic market economy to actually ask the market to begin to become more responsible?
Wait. Yeah, Bill, you've said many things I want to say, so mine will be very brief, and I speak here probably from the same sort of situation as many of you share of, you know, trying to get some understanding of what's going on in the world, and the first place you turn is the evening news. Occasionally we watch, you know, in our place at 6 o'clock or 5:30 for the national news, and there's some there, but most often we list in the evening at in Minneapolis area at 10 o'clock. And more, and I've seen the change take place in the last few years, and it's also taking place in the major metropolitan newspapers of the Twin Cities. There is very little news and very little depth to the news that's there. Occasionally I watch the news in the morning, it's almost totally entertainment where we are. The network and the local sort of thing does it, and they move on to sort of talk show format, both on TV and radio. And I'm going to put aside for the question whether there's sort of there's some sort of force behind that sort of consciousness, but the argument runs that the market controls what you have. and that people really don't want to and don't have the time and their energy to listen to news or analysis. If they do, they can turn on our place channel to PBS or to National Public Radio. And in popular media, this is about the only place you can turn unless you go to specific journals to get any sort of depth or interpretation of the news. And that is changing drastically. And so we hardly even get information. We have mostly entertainment, and you turn it on and you have sort of superstars. Somebody's in the news this week, or some great event that is there, you know, personality types, and it is almost totally what is presented there. And then the other dimension of it, I just wanted to touch that I'm sure you share as well, our stations, I suspect it's not too different elsewhere. The main news there is sort of the violence that is there. And it became Murderopolis, Minneapolis. I mean, that nice sort of pleasant city of lakes and green and shady areas and that. And so at 10 o'clock news every night, this is the latest murder or the near murder and so forth. And no depth upon that or that. And it's enough to scare senior citizens out of their wits that is there because they don't interpret it. They don't put it into context. And I come to the point, the argument is that this is the market. And I believe the market is a marvelous tool for allocating resources, an important part of life that we need to deal with. But here is a place in which more than the market needs to operate. We'll be talking about prophetic voice, a concern for justice, a concern for fairness, as well as a concern for depth of understanding. And how do we get it? And what voice do Christians have? And sort of asking for it, or you were saying having some levers here to ask for it.
Okay, I think I'll be so presumptuous to say that perhaps the view is shared within all of this group that something is wrong. Right? I think maybe we would agree in that. And the question then should be, I think Bill put it quite well when he said, as Christians, what is our responsibility to demand justice in terms of the information we get, or how can we make a change in this situation? So therefore, I open it to the forum. It's open, and let's just start discussing. I'll start here and then there. Okay.
Well, first of all, I'd say that don't watch television. I mean, that's a waste of time, as far as I'm concerned. Well, first of all, it's a linear media. In other words, your time is controlled by the station, not by you. But I read a good large city newspaper like the LA Times in our area. They cover things very much in depth. And you aren't bound by the time linear media television. You can scan the page, you can look up and down, right and left, and turn the page as quick as you want to. And there's no constraints and no ads to worry about. You skip over those ads like that and so on. Just don't watch television. That's the first thing to do if you want to get some news.
Well, me and my mom, we watch the news every once in a while. And this one time we were watching Channel 5 in Seattle, and they had stuff in the tabloids.
Yeah.
And that's just about the most untrue stuff to even think of. Mm. They were just totally advertising the tabloids. Mm. I mean, it's the news.
I think one thing that's interesting to note is when you talk about tabloids, is that we kind of think, somebody asked me the other day where we might get good information, and I forgot. Of course, you may not have the technology to do it, but the BBC has very good news broadcasts. And we have a tendency to think that because it's Great Britain, and because they probably seem to have a broader vocabulary than ours, that all the news in England is much better than we have. I'm telling you, it's not. On my satellite in Switzerland, I get what's called Sky, which is a cable network from England, and they do this very thing, the very same thing, every morning. It is just I don't know how many days we had to hear about that. The poor. I mean, I'm sorry Gianni Versace was killed, but my goodness, has this the lead story for 5 solid days? And then what they do is they pick up all of the tabloid newspapers, and if you think the tabloid newspapers are bad in this country, you should see what they're like in England. And then they read the headlines from all these newspapers. So I'm not discounting what's here in the United States, but it's also bad in some other places as well. Yes.
One of the things we learned in China when we were listening to shortwave was that Australia, when they're talking about what goes on in the United States, it's pretty good information. We could find out what was going on in the United States. But when we were there, Ross Perot became a candidate for the presidency, and we were bombarded by the Chinese asking us about Ross Perot. We never heard of Ross Perot. We didn't have the foggiest notion who he was, and couldn't have cared less. And same when we got home. So, you know, and when we did find out who he was. But they can't believe, you know, that we blow up these little things, and we don't have news. I don't know how to get it, except what I have to say this too. The Tacoma News Tribune, which is the paper that we take, if you open it up to the second page, all the stuff about everything all over the world is in little paragraphs like this, right underneath with caps, or not caps, but in bold type. And if you want to know some more, go www.blah blah blah. Well, I don't give a rip about sitting in front of one of those machines going yeah to find out what's going on in Cucamonga. I want them to print it in there, and if I have to go do that, then they're not doing me any favors. And in fact, that's why I read the newspaper. I could hook all that stuff up and get it through my computer, but I, you know, God.
You could read USA Today and get all the news you want in 10 minutes.
Time?
Yeah. Okay, so back to the
sorry. Just a couple observations. It does seem to me that we live in very much an information age, high technology. We are bombarded with more information than any single individual could possibly handle in a day, let alone in a lifetime. Computers nowadays, internet, everything makes so much available to us. It bombards us, and so there's a process of selection that goes on in what I want to listen to and what I want to read. I do this every day of my life. I can't take in everything. And I think a lot of our news people realize that. I think they just give you these little capsule things. Now, granted, a lot of us maybe doesn't give you the full picture. But I think what we're facing, in my opinion, is a byproduct of our highly technological, highly informational age that we live in. And so I struggle with, okay, what do I really need to know for this day, for this week, for this year, as I do my job, as I live with my family, as I live in this world, what do I really need to know?
So maybe what you're saying is that it takes some more effort. I mean, I think because we have grown up with television, we've always just seen ourselves as passive consumers. And what you're saying is now everything has changed and there's so much out there that we have to have the discipline and the will and the energy to decide what it is we need to know and then find the sources where we think we can get that. Okay, yes, please.
I was going to say, I think that television has become a very visual medium. Evening news will show whatever it has good pictures of.
Yeah.
And if they have a real story and a bad story, but it has good pictures, they'll show the pictures. But I do think that the internet's a marvelous tool. And if I have a certain amount of time to spend, you know, you can go in and do www.justaboutanynewspapername.com and get the headlines from the New York Times or the LA Times or the Times of London. And another thing that you can do, at least in Western Washington on cable, is you can get the Canadian news broadcasts, which are really a nice source of perspective sometimes about what's going on in this country.
I think we are a little more fortunate in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, because we have three public channels, and they do a very good job of endeavor reporting on news. And but they're suffering because it depends so much on membership subscription for support. And the only other news source we have is almost midnight, it's Nightline. And they do a pretty good in-depth reporting on it, but that's so late at night. It's just,
And I pick up on that, and that's true in the Twin Cities and the television media. These types of interpretive programs in the network do operate at a time that, 11 o'clock or later, and they do some excellent programming, But the local stations will not present them during time when most people could watch. I mean, if you're going to work in the morning and get up at 5:30 or 6:30, you're not going to be watching, you know, Nightline or similar program.
I have a question for you, I guess, Carol, about newspapers. I mean, I know you said that, of course, other countries have tabloids, but a newspaper that would be like a common city newspaper in someplace in Europe, is it more likely, do you think, to cover in-depth stories around the world than an American newspaper? Because my sense is that in the United States, we're essentially kind of still kind of isolationist, and our concerns have to do with this country, and it's very difficult for us to imagine another country's, what's going on in another country, unless it's an utter disaster, to be of great interest. I mean, there's all this stuff, you know, people, we don't know who's the, you know, who's the premier of France, who's, you know, who are the leaders in other nations even.
It's interesting when you go to Germany or just see the numbers of newspapers that there are in Europe compared with the numbers there are. I mean, newspapers are dying in the United States, and it's not the case in a place like Munich. There'll be four or five papers, or in Germany there'll be, and they're various tied to various political parties, the Süddeutsche Zeitung, the Frankfurt Allgemeine, and in France you've got Figaro and all the Monde. But I think, something just crossed my mind that if anyone is interested in subscribing, and I'm sure you can do it now in the United States, to a really good paper, try the International Herald Tribune, which has always been the newspaper that Americans read when they were traveling in Europe. It has published by the New York Times and the Washington Post. And because it is a truly international newspaper, it's now published in Zurich, it's published in the Far East, you can get it anywhere. It has a really good, wide, broad spectrum of international reporting. If there's an election in France, there'll be a report about that. And also the editorial page is very, very good. Some of the best editorial writers of the papers in the United States, and some of the others in Europe as well. So think about that. The International Herald Tribune, it's excellent.
It's fairly small, though. It's pretty thin.
It's fairly thin, but there's not a lot of ads in it. You see, when you compare the ads in a U.S. newspaper, what you get there is, it's not a lot, but what there is good. And I think it's a good alternative, at least. Okay, yes, you'd like to say something.
Well, it's a couple of things. In Seattle, we have two newspapers. One has a liberal slant, and the other one has a more liberal slant. They have agendas, and they make no bones about it. They print their agendas. If you expect a newspaper with that kind of attitude to really inform you without them saying what we need to hear according to them, then you're crazy. They're not going to do that.
Right.
And on the other side is like KVI radio, talk radio in Seattle. You can get all kinds of wonderful information slanted towards the conservative side. But the difficulty with that is, if you're going to get all of the information on Christians being killed in Africa and all of these other things that we all need to know about, the amount of time it takes is incredible, because they start at 5 o'clock in the morning and then you stop listening at 9 because Limbaugh comes on, and then you start again at noon and go until 5. And you get a tremendous amount of really good information, but that's an awful lot of time.
Is there one more? Yes.
I think that a concern of mine is the loss of the independent paper. They're being purchased by large. And what an opportunity for someone to manage the news.
Mm-hmm.
We get that
right.
I hear that. Lines. I think we need to have that independent. I don't know people here from Iowa, but we always found the Des Moines Register was really a fine paper.
You bet.
It's well but I've heard it's been purchased as part of a large.
Yeah. Well, I think we've agreed that there are problems, and we have come up with some solutions, possibly about how to look for good sources of news. They're still out there, maybe few and far between. It may take some effort to get there, but it is possible. Now I'm wondering if we could move to some of the larger issues or the broader issues that both of my colleagues have brought up about how we might, as a Christian community, make some changes in this, or I'll let you, since you have articulated them so well, why don't you throw out a couple more questions based on what you said before.
Well, the concerns I had in one in getting some sort of depth that would encourage people to get understanding, a variety of perspectives that are there. I don't think it's only a Christian concern, but I think many others share that sort of thing, that we have some attention to issues of justice. Justice in the sense of fairness, that you're just not sort of entertaining people, but you also attempt to have people open up their consciences on the news. And I see less and less of that. And because to deal with certain kinds of issues, including religious issues, is to offend your audience. And so on the one hand, you want to entertain, but you don't want to do anything too disturbing. And violence, by the way, is very entertaining, at least on the blood level. You get into the pictures and that, and you talked about the visual sort of signs that are there. You know, if they can get the footage before the 10 o'clock or the 11 o'clock news, that's what goes, because they, they're like ambulance-chasing lawyers.
Right, what do they say? It's always amazing. They give you some...
Film at 11.
Yeah, film at 11. Some terrible, something horrible has happened, and they say, the picture's at 11.
Picture's at 11, and it may or not be something terrible, but it is gory. And then they'll talk to the... the victims or the victim's family or the neighborhood, and what did you think about that? Your boy got shot, in the crossfire, and that's the level of it.
That I think that's another question that when we were planning this, we talked about. To what extent can we continue to see those terrible images of violence, and continue then to have some kind of empathy or sympathy or where does that lead? Because it's kind of an escalating thing. And obviously it sells. It sells. It sells newspapers and it
the ratings.
And the ratings, yeah. I don't know. What happens?
We've stopped watching television.
That's right. So we listen to the radio, we read, we interact with our children, we do all of these things. That I don't understand how people have time to sit and watch all of the stupid programs. I mean, I don't know how we'd ever have time for our children or anything if we did that.
I try to pick up some news in the mornings, and I confer with other people I work with during the day, and I talk to them about certain things that have come up, and they have never even listened to the news. They don't bother.
Yeah.
Some of them. Mm-hmm. Just read the sport page.
Yeah. So in a way, they are really they're voting not, on this issue saying, with their inattention.
Yeah. It can't follow. Another thing, seems to me like the people in the foreign countries are more informed of what's going on here in our country and around the world than we are.
They are.
Yes. That's been my experience, yes.
What you were talking about with the increase in China violence, it seems to me that it's almost a myth that the news tries to put across that we live in a time of scarcity and we live in a time when we're in great danger and we live in a time when we need to circle the wagons, take care of our own, and not reach out to other people. And I think that a lot of that showing, crime rates have gone down. Violent crime rates have gone down. But the news coverage has shifted such that you would think that the opposite was true. And I think think that it's leading people to make decisions that stop justice. It makes them afraid of decor. It makes them afraid of the different. It makes them feel like they have to hang on to what they have to protect themselves. So I think it's more than just a dampening of our sense of horror. I think it goes into changing how we view the world.
Yeah, that's a very wise comment. Yeah.
I agree, television does have some very gory things on it, but in the Bay Area, if we fail to turn on our television set, half the people will never get to work because they'll never know how traffic is. Conduct a survey of their membership. If you're a paying member of the public channel, they ask what kind of programming you want. The other towns do not ask that, but the public channels do ask, and they respond to what your suggestions.
We live in Minneapolis area, the Twin Cities, and the big news is always the weather. But you turn to trend, you know, each forecast is different. The newspapers are different, and you know their batting average is not good. But that is the news. But if you live in Hawaii or the Bay Area, it's probably not low priority.
Oh, not hurricane season. No, very high priority.
I remember when I first moved to Minneapolis in 1974. I was so impressed that right down in the Nicollet Mall, across from Dayton's, there was a little box. And yeah, it literally said the weather to you. There was a little voice in there that gave you a constant weather report.
They all have a professional meteorologist.
I'd like to try just one maybe different angle to see if we can move the conversation then maybe get to just saw Bob's hand. I mentioned earlier to a group, I think yesterday, that sometimes when the Bible doesn't have the necessary story I'm looking for, I rely on my imagination to fill in the gap. This story is about what happened to Jesus after the ascension. And we know what happened to the disciples, but what happened to Jesus after the ascension? This is the story. Jesus ascended into heaven, and God the Father was so happy, decided to throw a party. And all of the angels came because God was throwing the party. They thought it was a wise thing to do to come. And they were all sort of talking nicely to Jesus and about what had happened. And finally, one of the angels, who was most curious, came up to Jesus and said, "Okay, I know I should probably know, but please tell me." He said, "What did you really do down there?" He said, "Oh, that's a good question." He said, "Well, I started the church." And the angel went, oh. He said, "Well, what's the church?" And he said, "Well, these 12 wonderful guys and about 5 or 6 women in the background currently because the culture's not quite ready for them to be up front. But and what they've agreed to do is to tell my story. And it's going to change the world." "Oh." And the angel says, "Well, Jesus, well, what's your plan if that doesn't work?" And Jesus said, "I don't have one." How did the Apostle Paul use media to advance the church? His media was letters. What were his letters filled with? And could that be a hint for what our media should be filled with? And if we are the church, if it ain't gonna happen, if we don't do it, what are we called to do to ask the media to become more of what Paul insisted his media be?
No, mine was to an earlier point.
I think that's interesting because I think that the, what I call the right-wing Christian wackos have done just exactly that. They have bombarded the Congress and the President and everybody all the way down through the media everywhere. They are so well organized that we are getting their message. And I feel like standing up saying, "Wait a minute, you said you were a Christian. I'm a Christian too." And I'm getting to the point where I'm doing that. You know, it's kind of like, And telling people, say, do you mind if I smoke? Yes, I do. It makes me sick, you know? it's the reaction, and that's really not the way I want to be about it. I want my Christian witness to be right there, but I don't want to have to say it. But they're saying it. They're saying, I'm a Christian witness. I said, yeah? Whoa, excuse me. You know, I don't really believe in your political Christian witness.
At one point in the gospel, I'm not exactly sure where, Jesus said something like, he wished that the children of light were as clever as the children of darkness.
Yes.
I agree that letter writing is very important, but I think that it's important perhaps to write to those who sponsor these shows. I think you probably will, because the show is sponsored, it costs a lot of money, and if the people who pay that money hear from us that we don't approve, maybe we would get further than writing to the paper or the TV station.
A good point. Yes.
How can the most important thing on the news be the weather? Can they give us something that we don't already know? I mean, see, yeah, you think of rain. Mostly it's rain.
You haven't lived in Minnesota, then.
They have to give us all this high pressure, low pressure stuff. It's supposed to make us think, whoa. This is interesting. I should watch this.
No, you're right. Now, I moved from the West Coast to Minnesota, and the first thing I thought was amazing. Half of the newscast was
half the newscast. Even almost as much time as sports.
And believe me, you get vitally interested in it. It's very important to you if you live in a
believe it.
You do. You care a lot.
It tells you what to wear and what the driving conditions are going to be and all that sort of stuff.
Whether you can get to work.
Yes, but it doesn't have to take it happening.
No, it doesn't have to take it.
Say rain again, go back in.
But the weather has become entertainment too.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
I mean, they're competing. Who is the jazziest sort of weather forecasters?
Is there any reason why we have to have that on as news? No. That's facts. That's not news.
That's the way I feel about the sports.
Who cares? Well, sports is entertainment.
Who cares?
I mean, I think news should be news. News should be what is affecting our community. Right?
Yeah. And our global community.
Global community is part of that community.
Well, I think that speaks to what Bill was saying about the letters that united community. I think the point that I'm getting, you're saying, is communication as community builder.
Thank you.
That's right. And how are our communities built by our different types of communication? It's not little communities huddled around listening to a letter being read. As we're describing it, it's people in front of a screen, and at most family units, usually the smaller units, watching individually. But we are having a community experience. I mean, millions and millions of people watch Tom Brokaw and have a shared experience of watching. Millions and millions of people watch the television shows that are their community-defining experiences, even if they're not doing it in the same room with all the people they're doing it, and I think this is all having a powerful effect on defining us as a people.
If I could build on that for just a second, I've not lived in a country where a totalitarian regime was in power, but I understand that when that takeover happens, the things that get controlled quickest are the intellectuals and the media and the leaders who would ask for change. And maybe we don't need to implement that sort of intimidation of intellectuals and free thinkers, because what would happen if you just saturated the airways with nonsense and all of the best thinkers just began to turn off their TVs, not knowing that 88% of the country is leaving them on, and that all of your neighbors that who live around you and go to church with you are watching this stuff, and this incredible institution that could be used for good is just draining the intellectual and ethical and maybe just instincts that we have away from the decision making that goes on in the community. Because we're just saturated with nonsense.
Going back to your comment about Paul's letters, just thinking what they said, they were very encouraging. They gave instruction, and they told the gospel story. And they knitted that community together as it was kind of fragmented throughout at that point, where the communication would go in the world. So it's interesting as we were reading to how that model applies to us today.
I don't think a lot of people that are in charge of those media have any kind of sense of responsibility towards that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people who run television are not necessarily the news departments, but I assume you know the network entertainment programs. They're children. For the most part.
I think the people that run the TV, as far as TV being a community builder, right now the advertisers are the people that run all the programming. Because it's completely structured as far as, even now shows are created to sell products. So I think TV can't be a community builder because it's tailored around consumerism and us Americans buying products and buying what they see. And I think it's a big issue there, because how can this tool be used to build community when it's used to just promote consumerism?
It's very interesting. I've spent a lot of time in a kibbutz in Israel, and my husband was there even before I came. And I've seen the profound changes. I mean, this is the institution of the kibbutz was an extremely close society where, you know, everyone ate together. There's a communal laundry. Everything was done in community. Every evening there'd be discussions. And literally when television came in, it says, my husband isn't here tonight, but Tom would say, the serpent was loosened in Eden. And now when I go back there, they used to have one television in the main kind of clubhouse. Then there was a desire to have television in every home. And once the television got in every home, everything that had been involved in those discussions and communities coming together for programming and whatever, it's totally collapsed. People are now in their little houses at night. You can walk through the whole kibbutz and you see the flashing of the television screen. Nobody's talking anymore. They're just in there. They do their work. They take their meals at home, and they go to their television, and they sit there and they watch. It's had a profound, profound effect on that institution.
You just described the United States of America. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we do.
So let me...
Carlos.
Yep. Go ahead. I mean, what television is here, radio is my impression throughout the world that almost no place where you cannot get from a transistor radio. It has its positive and its negative sides. And so there's a possibility here of information in the remotest part of Africa or Russia or any place long ago. There was a little radio and a battery, and you could connect here that. And we've talked here about the internet, and I'm just sort of moving on towards that. On the positive side, and this even moved away from our justice question, it's more and more difficult to deliberately control the news, because the news can come through. You can be any place in the world and get the BBC, the sort of thing. And the meanwhile, and the sort of thing, the regular channels are becoming thinner and thinner. And those are both logical sort of change. that we're knit together by information. And the information is available to everybody.
There are some agencies now, or there's talk among some development agencies about development moving from what we usually think of development being giving, assisting people with things, but that what's probably coming is assisting people with information. Because it's interesting, when you're in Africa, you notice that if you want to take an airplane, let's say you want to fly from Ethiopia, and we tried this because we had a meeting, try to fly from Ethiopia to Ghana. You can't do it. You have to go to Europe. Everything goes north and south. Very little goes east and west, and that's because, you know, you have more passengers, and airlines they're there to make money too. But the possibility of the internet is quite amazing, that information can now, does not have to be kind of filtered through Europe. It's an astonishing thing to think about, that people do, development agencies are now providing people with access to the internet, and they're almost, there's servers everywhere, that this is, we're on the threshold of making this kind of information, and it is power, available on a much more egalitarian way. I think it's like everything, there's a good side to it and a bad side to it, but this is rather a good side. For example, we've had some field programs that needed information about certain kind of soils, and they were trying to, it was interesting, just about a month ago, I was on a planning mission to Malawi, and we were walking through some kind of field, I can't remember what the crop was, and there was a real problem with the weeds. And but at the same time, Malawi is a country that grows a lot of tobacco. And the agriculturalist that I was with said, didn't you know that they've done in such and such place where they take the tobacco and boil it, and this is a natural herbicide.
Right.
And these guys didn't even know it. But I'm seeing the work that I do now in Geneva, it used to be more of a coordination of people and things, and I think it's going to go to a point where it's going to be more of a coordination of information, and that in Africa itself and other places where people are doing, where Africans are doing the development work rather than the northerner experts coming in, that they will one day be able to ask those kinds of questions, and the questions will come to us and we'll send back the information, which I'm looking forward to.
Back to your point about the effectiveness of the Christian right. You know, as Carol, as you were talking, I couldn't help but think that, you know, when the printing press first was developed, one of the first major pieces printed on that new piece of technology was the Bible, and Luther's ambitions to get the word into all people's hands. What is the equivalent sort of call that we have? We have another tool now, and it's information in all kinds of forms. What can we do to ensure that the church will prosper because of that? And how can we be as effective as religious right in that?
Support the religious right.
You mean anything we support falls?
Tell you what, look at it from this perspective. That world out there is eating us alive. We're being murdered around the world. So many of the people in our Christian community have become so liberal, but you really can't tell them apart from anyone else. I think there's a place for the religious right. All of you may not agree with it, but there's a place for those people. They have a point of view. And if you don't like it, fine.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Criticizing him.
Well, that isn't the point. I mean, maybe that isn't the point. I think what happens is we get
But the religious right takes on, I mean, and I'm using this in quotes, takes on a political stand and says, this is the Christian stand. This is the Christian point of view. It is not
that's what
that,
the media wants you to know.
All right. But that is what we're hearing. And I think that that is stated. In fact, I know it's stated. I've heard it stated. And if... I totally agree. I don't think Christianity is. I mean, if we say we are inclusive, we include everybody. We are all forgiven. We are not accepted by God because we believe this or this or this. It's when we say, you know, you are condemned because you do this. Now, I don't know. This is a problem because now we have Amos, you know, in our midst, and we're talking about Amos, who says, you'll be punished. You know, God's going to destroy you if you don't change your ways. And I think that's where we all start to get on rocky ground. When we do feel like we are in a position to condemn what is going on in the world, whether we're against abortion or whether we're against genocide, I think that we have to take stands as individuals and maybe take our community with us and say, this is my belief system. But when you're bringing up, you know, the religious, you know, I'm a Christian, and then I know exactly what you mean. You feel like I don't want to say I'm a Christian because if I say it publicly, I will be immediately associated with a complete set of beliefs that I don't agree with. And I wonder about this, Bill, when we talk about it as a Christian church making political statements, there are a lot of people who are Christians. And who are we to judge whose voice is right? It gets to be very complicated, doesn't it? I mean, do you think that any of us has a corner in the market? Because I wonder that myself. I mean, who is right when we start talking politically? I know what I believe politically about a lot of things. It's based on what I think is following Christ's teachings, which are also compatible with a lot of things that my generation grew up with, having witnessed what happened to a generation, maybe happened to a generation before, although I learn more and more about them and I see what they suffered and understand some of the things that made them what they are too. But these are interesting questions as well. When we start talking as a unit about how Christians should act politically in the world, am I just getting really confusing and making this very blurry? I think it becomes an issue when we act in the world, though. Because where do we stand? Do we take a stand as a Christian, or do we take a stand as an individual? You know, do we say, this is what I believe? Or do I say, I take the Christian church behind me. You know, I know I can trust that this is what my faith has told us we should do.
How would Dr. King answer your question?
I want to try to answer that one, too.
I think you're asking a great question. What I heard you ask is that should we as Christians take political stands in the world? And so my response was a question. How would Dr. King answer that, do you think?
Oh, I didn't hear her say that.
Okay. I mean, that's what I heard, Martin. And if she can...
Well, to me, it's... I guess what I'm saying is, at what point is our faith politicized? At what point do we say this is a political thing that has to be stated because I'm a Christian? And at what point is this is what is humanitarian? This is what a lot of people believe, who believe in what is good and what is true, or what I think is true, and beauty, and an egalitarian world, which is not necessarily Christian. I don't know that that is what Christianity is. I think it's based on a lot of Christian principles, but there are a lot of humanitarians who don't have to say, don't have to hold a cross up and can say that.
Okay, I agree with that. But I thought the question I was hearing is, as a Christian, do you have political responsibilities?
I think you have a responsibility to act, but I'm not always clear. And I mean, I consider myself quite a liberal, but I'm not always clear on what separates me and makes my voice right, as opposed to a fundamentalist who I maybe firmly disagree with. You know, I mean,
it's a good question.
I'm not trying to get away from the subject. But I think that as Christians making a stand in the world, I'm often tempted to write a letter and say, you know, you're getting all, you know, to the editor and saying, we hear from the Christian right all the time. This is the Christian, this is another point of view. Then I'm thinking, why does the Christian right have to say, why are we politicizing and saying, you know, I'm
the
part
right
of the Christian,
Christian
right? Why is the right Christian? And why is the left Christian?
Or not to speak to it for us all.
That's what I'm trying to.
You said the press made us, wanted us to believe that.
Yeah, you were saying that, and I thought that was. I'm going to pick that up, but I'd like to hear more of what you'd say. I want to talk to that too.
Do you believe that the press treats the Christian right fairly?
Oh heavens, no.
Well, that's interesting.
No way.
I don't think they do.
Christians in general.
I think it's a part of they don't drink Christians in general, or other religious expressions in general either.
Christian right says it's controversial, and they'll just blow it totally out of proportion, and that's all you ever hear about the Christian right. Is what they want.
I think
to
we
hear.
can see that the media generally has a liberal.
Oh, absolutely.
It has a liberal bias. I think it has an anti-religious bias.
I agree with
that. I always sort of, you know, turn off people who talk about secular humanism, but the media is clearly very, very secular, and those who are doing the prime interpreters of the news give an interpretation here that is alien, not only to the Christian right, but to Christian left and Christian middle and to Muslims and Jews and just about everybody else. And so religious people, anybody with a deep religious conviction, do not get a fair hearing in the major news media.
Let's start this way and go this way, okay? There.
I think what the news does, it takes our views and turns them into sound bites.
Yes.
And that's such an issue, because look at the Lutheran statement on sexuality. The news took it, and it was broadcast on national news that Lutherans say you should use condoms, and you, and one other issue. And
after me.
And how can you get your Christian stance across when, if you can't eloquently say it in 20 seconds or less, then you can't say it.
And then you're judged, and you're labeled, and you are this, and you are that.
That's an oversimplification issue that's really universal on every.
An issue I was hearing in this conversation was making a distinction between saying, I am a Christian, and my faith leads me to take this point of view, and someone else who might say, if you're a Christian, this is what you, what point of view or what candidate you will support. And I think there's a clear distinction between those two modes of action without labeling who does one and who does another.
That's a good point. That's a really good point.
Okay, yes.
They like turn the Christian right into anything they want it to be. The Christian right is what they want, not what the Christians want. They just take some issue that they're talking about and put in their point of view and say it's the Christian right.
I told this to Bill earlier tonight, and I'll repeat it now. One of the largest Lutheran churches in the world is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Tanzania. It now has over 2.5 million members, and thanks to the German missionaries who were there. But it's a very large, vital church. And in Tanzania, I believe 2 years ago, they had their first multi-party election in the history of the country. usually there had been only one party running, one party candidate, the Chama-Cha Muppin Doozy Party. But this time they had a series of candidates, and I was so extremely proud of that church. I happen to know a number of the leadership of that church who are very well educated and are very, very good people. And on their own, they decided that their constituency as Christians, and here you're living in a situation that is about 50% Christian and about 50% Muslim, and sometimes there's some frictions between the group, but by and large, it's an example of a Christian and Muslim community living quite well together. In fact, there's even intermarriage. So the church said, we're now going into a political process that we have never experienced as a Tanzanian people and as a church. So they put together kind of a booklet in Swahili, which they circulated to the entire church, talking about what the Christian responsibility was in this kind of a situation. Number one, not to be afraid of it, that to be a Christian did not mean that you were outside the political process, it wasn't sinful, but calling on the membership of the church to get involved in the process, not telling them what side to take, but also giving them some guidelines, because in a place like Tanzania, where this is a totally new and open process, it was kind of funny because huge numbers of newspapers sprung up overnight and they were printing the most outrageous things, and the church was saying, now look at these things, look at what someone says very carefully, don't simply believe everything you hear, don't believe everything you read. But I thought it was a quite marvelous thing for a church to do in a situation that was almost like a, to some extent, a blossoming of a democratic system. Hmm. So that's how they saw it, at least. Not to take
Can we get a translation of that stuff?
not to take a pull. And I don't know how things will go on. I mean, this was just the beginning, and perhaps on certain issues the church will say, this is how we stand. Certainly, we've done that in the past. And international issues, the biggest one, at least that I can recall within the Lutheran Church, was when we said at the assembly, I believe in, I'm not sure, that the issue of apartheid was wrong, that that was an issue of status confessionis, that you could not confess to be a Christian and uphold an apartheid system. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I think there are issues, maybe this is where it has to hit us, that Christ meets us where people are hurting, where people are in pain. And there has to, that maybe has to confront us somehow as individual Christians. And when we start blanketing, putting things in a big, if we're just as susceptible to creating sort of little, what's the word? Sort of a propaganda for each other about what's going, to sort of grab everybody to come our way. We can do that within the church. And I think we have to see the individual human suffering. And I think that maybe that's what we lack in the media. And that's why we become, we become sort of stony about things, is that we can't, somehow or other, we can't contact within ourselves the human being that is bleeding or that is hungry. It becomes a statistic because the mass statistic is what's dramatic and epic and historical. The individual suffering is not.